Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're here to render judgment on the worlds of celebrity, pop culture, television, and fashion.
Strap yourselves in for some hardcore opinionating, darlings.
This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
With Tom and Lorenzo.
And this is the Pop Style Opinion Fest. Hello, kittens. Welcome back to another edition of the PSO. I am the T in your T, Lo, Tom Fitzgerald. I'm here with the Lou in your T, Lo, Lorenzo Marquez, my lovely house.
Hello.
It is a very happy house, a very happy week in the T, Lo household.
It's a very happy house.
It's a very happy house. It is a very happy house. Yes, we got to announce the news about our new book, which, you know what? We're going to put that aside for a few minutes. Of course, we're going to talk about it because did you expect any less from us for this week's podcast? But you're going to be hearing so much about this book in the next year and a half. So we'll try and temper how much we talk about it. Before we do that, Lorenzo, how are you, my dear? You're looking at me with love in your eyes.
I'm doing fine. It's just fine. Things are very busy.
We're heading into the very end of award season.
Right. We decided not to do Fashion Week because...
Oh, I meant to bring that up. Yes.
Because of all the craziness going on with the book and everything, we just didn't have
We're
the
not
time.
Going at all. This is the first time in, I think, 10 years.
Over 10 years, yeah.
Where we are not going at all. Not to anything. And that was a very late decision.
Right.
Literally only a couple of days ago, we were like, you know what, with the book and everything else.
We have a deadline
of April 15th to get 12 chapters and an introduction done.
So it's just too much. And when you're in New York for Fashion Week, it's already hell because we attend shows all day and then we have to go back to the...
There would be no writing for a full week.
We go back to the hotel and then we have to pose, you know, work on the pose for the next day. So there would be no time for the book and we just can't have that.
So I'm glad you brought that up. Before we flipped on the mics, I meant to say we should talk about how we're not going to Fashion Week.
It's such a weird feeling because I'm looking
it is
at
weird.
I'm looking at the pictures and the red carpet, not the red carpet, the front row and all that, and I'm like, so weird not to be there because usually when I see those pictures, I'll go, yeah, I saw her there, I saw him there, we were there in the room somewhere when I see those pictures, and now I'm like, oh. We're not there.
I kind of hate it because I have worked so hard at the gym this year.
Aww.
And now all my super stylish Fashion Week clothes fit me perfectly.
And you're not going.
And I'm not going.
Anyway.
But
you're still going to look wonderful next season. And
we're definitely going next season.
Yeah, we're going to keep on going. It was just one break.
It's impossible. The work on the book is all day, every day. We'll get into that in a bit, but we would not have been able to do Fashion Week, or we would have had to split up and one of us go and the other one stay behind to work.
No.
And it wasn't gonna work. So boohoo, that's kind of sad. This is the first February in at least 10 years where we're not going to a Fashion Week show in New York. But we'll get over it. Maybe we'll have some you know, because we don't have to worry about fitting into our clothes. Maybe we'll have some carbs this week
or something like
that, which is a wonderful segue to talk about Baked by Melissa, who was sponsoring this portion of the podcast and who sent us a box cupcakes, which were, oh my God, we devoured them. It's actually a good thing we weren't going to Fashion Week because we devoured them. Baked by Melissa makes perfectly bite-sized treats in an array of unique handcrafted flavors. They're easy to gift, easy to love, and deliver a wow factor in every bite. And they do. These are small bite-sized cupcakes. What's great about them is... And I said this to Lorenzo. I was like, you know, Valentine's Day, I'm not a candy person. I'm not someone who loves getting a box of candy. After two or maybe three, I'm like, all right, I'm not into it.
That's enough chocolate, yeah.
But give me a box of baked goods. And they have these gorgeous Valentine's flavors, these gorgeous boxes. And they're all tiny. They're like the size of a confection that you would get in a, maybe a little bit bigger. They're like bite-sized cupcakes, loaded with flavor. You know I'm a home baker. You've heard me talk about it on this podcast many times. And you also probably know, having listened to me, that I'm a snob about
yes, you are.
Baked goods that I didn't bake myself. This is Tom approved. The flavors on these cupcakes were amazing. And you would pop one into your mouth, get all of these amazing flavors, and feel like you had eaten a cupcake three or four times its size.
The great thing about it is that, you know, with a regular cupcake, you know, you have a bite or two or three, and then you kind of like done with it, with that flavor, but you kind of finish it anyway because you're eating it. But these small bite, you know, they're bite-sized cupcakes. They're perfect because they're just the right amount, right size for just, you know, you want to try something and then it's that wonderful flavor.
Right.
And then you get a box with so many different flavors. I mean, you actually get a little menu so that you can, you know exactly what you're eating.
A box of like Valentine's chocolate.
Right.
But bite-sized cupcake. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Every bite-sized cupcake is stuffed, iced, and topped entirely by hand. Baked by Melissa chooses only the most delicious ingredients like Hershey's fudge, Oreo cookies, and the best cookie butter you've ever tasted. They make them small so you can try them all. Melissa created their bite-sized cupcakes so people could taste more flavors without the post-dessert guilt. And I have to say, it's true. Like, I would pop four of these in my mouth in quick succession. And I didn't feel stuffed. I mean, I felt a little guilty, but I didn't feel stuffed because it's just this tiny little flavor punch. Baked by Melissa has eight original great flavors that are always available, seasonal collections, a new mini of the month cupcake every month, and limited edition assortments you have to taste to believe. There are special Valentine's Day flavors like milk chocolate, red velvet, strawberry made with real strawberries and buttery streusel, vanilla cream, and more. Baked by Melissa's February flavors are specially picked to go better together. And Baked by Melissa offers gluten-free favorites that are perfect for every day. So, this Valentine's Day, send your loved ones the perfect gift with Baked by Melissa. Go to bakedbymelissa.com. That's bakedbymelissa.com/TLO today to sign up and use promo code TLO to get 15% off your next order. This is a special offer exclusively for podcast listeners, so make sure you take advantage. That's 15% off at bakedbymelissa.com/TLO using promo code TLO. Baked by Melissa offers 1 and 2 day shipping nationwide. Remember the last day for standard shipping for Valentine's Day, which, again, we recommend this as a Valentine's Day treat.
It's
a perfect, and oh, the box is adorable.
Oh my God.
With little hearts all over it. Really, really cute.
It's cute.
Cute setup, cute delivery, and the cupcakes are delicious. So remember the last day for standard shipping for Valentine's Day. Delivery is February 12th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. BakedByMelissa.com/TLO. Use promo code TLO to get 50% off your next order. Thank you, Baked by Melissa. All right. Racist sweaters.
Yes.
Go.
Oh my God, we're not done. And it's Black History Month.
and
things are just out of control.
God, it has been Blackface History Month.
I know. I don't understand that. But it's so. Oh yeah, it's horrifying. But
fill
Gucci.
Gucci, who just finished their last racist imagery scandal with, remember the little, wasn't it Gucci?
That was Prada.
Oh, that was Prada. I'm sorry. I'm mixing up my racist
Italian
brands.
All the Italian brands are managing.
Seriously? Dolce & Gabbana.
I know.
The Italian brands are having some problems this year.
So Gucci put out this sweater that covers half of your face.
It's a turtleneck that you can pull up over your mouth, which, okay, gross. but it's got a hole in the part that covers your mouth with a pair of big red lips painted over it. And the sweater that caused all the stir, it was a black sweater. So if you pull the black sweater over your mouth with big red lips painted over your, it's hard not to see. That is like blackface, minstrels blackface.
Right. It's really, really bad. And I mean, we've talked so much about this already. I don't understand how you make that decision to say, yes, this is a great idea. Let's produce and sell it.
Right.
And promote it. I don't understand those decisions.
No.
I don't understand how you have so much money, especially Gucci, my God, and then you do not have people. And that's a lot of people pointed out already. You know, they need more people of
color.
They need
Americans. Because clearly, they're between the Prada thing and this, I think there is some lack of understanding about racist imagery, about blackface imagery, especially in the American market and culture. And, you know, you're selling to Americans, not...
That's
you know.
The thing. These brands are very international, and they sell everywhere. So you're not just selling to Italians. I mean, you're selling your stuff to everybody in the whole world. So you do have to take all these cultural...
And Gucci has an African-American fan base.
Right.
I mean... Clientele, like
right?
It's a brand known among like I mean, there's the Dapper Dan collaboration,
right?
So
right. So you do have to take these things into consideration, and you have to hire people, consultants that can help you make decisions so that to avoid that type of thing. It's just really, really bad. And the thing is that they only apologize after, you know, after the backlash. It's always the case. You never see them pulling the item, you know, off the shelves. On their own.
No.
It's always because...
They always seem caught off guard by it.
Right,
like,
exactly.
What?
I didn't... And I wish for once, not that it would change anything, but I wish once they would, just once, they would come out with a statement that wasn't just an apology, but actually explain what the thought process was to come up with that idea. No, we had this in mind, and we thought that we were doing this and that and that, but obviously failed. You know, instead of just like, we apologize for any inconvenience or whatever, some... You know, bullshit standard apologies that
right.
that they
thoughts
always,
and prayers.
Yes, why not just you know just don't know. This is what we had in mind. Our inspiration was this, and you know, but obviously we screwed it up. Anyway, but it's just very. I mean, things are so bad, and every day something else. And I don't want to get into politics, but it's just so bad for Black History Month. You know, we're supposed to be celebrating.
But you know
many,
what?
Many wonderful things, and this is what we're faced with almost every day now.
The history, Black history in America, is the history of racism in America.
Right.
So,
yes. Right. Exactly.
It's. I'm sure this is painful for African Americans to constantly be faced with this. On the other hand, it might be a good idea that this is all coming up in Black History Month. We're talking not just about the Gucci thing, but Governor Northam in Virginia, who is facing this huge scandal for blackface pictures in his... I mean, the whole... Virginia is about to just lose all of its
Seriously?
Top elected officials because they all did blackface in college in the 80s. So that's currently going on. And then this Gucci thing is going on. And in a minute, we're going to get into Liam Neeson's stunning
yeah.
foot in mouth moment. But there's a part of me, and I recognize that I sit here in all my privilege saying this. It's easy for me to say this. And I completely recognize that there is a different point of view out there that's probably more valid than my own. But I do think it's good that we're having these conversations. Like, let's do it. Let's turn over every
right.
bit of dirt and let's have a conversation about, you know what? White people did do a lot of blackface at Halloween and at frat parties all through the 80s and 90s, and they're still doing it today. There's always this indignant response, like with Northam's pictures, like, people were not doing that in the 80s. Yeah, they were. I have specific memories of people at Halloween parties in blackface. Yeah, they were. I didn't do it. Thank God I wasn't that dumb back then. I never did it. I don't have to live with that. But I know people who are still in my life who did that back then. And I know for a fact that they must be struggling with that. That they,
right.
you know, from 30 years ago, they did something that is just people would find appalling today.
Well, it's one thing. It's one thing. I'm not justifying, obviously. But
no.
It's one thing to go to a Halloween party, but to actually publish a picture in a yearbook?
Well, what gets me about him is...
In a
yearbook, privilege.
Yeah. Right.
That you just thought you could put that... Like, you didn't have even the wherewithal to be slightly embarrassed by it. Not only that, but you pursued a life in politics.
Right.
And never thought that that would haunt you. You had to. I mean, I don't buy this idea that he didn't know it was there.
Oh, that's bullshit.
Of course not. So you knew for almost 40 years that there was a picture of you in blackface in your college yearbook, and you went into politics
anyway.
You didn't do a thing to try and scrub it or get rid of it because you're so awash in privilege that you don't think it could ever possibly affect you. And to be fair, prior to 5 or 10 years ago, this might have been a scandal he could ride out. But times have changed. The social justice, the ideas of social justice are changing, and people are not putting up with this. I don't know what's going to happen to him, but and I'm not even offering my opinion on what should happen to him, because that's getting far too into the weeds of politics. But yes, this February has just been, all right, everybody show their racist asses this
month. It's just everything. And then yesterday, the abolition of civil rights. I mean, obviously, he misread the teleprompter.
Trump. Yeah, well, let's not get into that anymore.
But it's like, how can you even read that? And I mean, if I'm reading something and it's wrong, I will stop.
You should probably explain, even though I don't want to get into this, but he said the phrase, he praised the abolition of civil rights in the speech he gave yesterday. Which,
because he is...
Whatever, let's go, let's move on. Liam Neeson. Don't go there. This man watches MSNBC for like 10 hours a day.
Oh my God, stop it. That is not true.
Yes,
that
he does.
That is not true, and I stopped watching. No, I stopped watching, and I'll tell you why I stopped watching. Yes, I used to watch MSNBC a lot, but I stopped watching the news.
And we know for a fact that some people at MSNBC listen to our podcast, so we don't want to badmouth their work.
No.
It's important work, but it's not something people should watch 12 hours a day.
I do admire some of them, and that's why I was watching... you know, a lot, but I don't do it anymore because I feel that it's not adding anything to my conversation, to our conversation.
Right.
You're just watching people talk about something, and then the next day is a different topic, and then we talk. What I'm trying to say is I'm just tired of talking.
Yeah.
And being part of that conversation that leads nowhere.
Right.
And I think that's what the media is doing lately, TV shows and all that. They just want to talk about it. And I'm tired because it's not one thing. It's one thing a day.
Right. An hour.
So it's just, it's exhausting and it really affects my day. And so anyway, I haven't watched the news. I just read stuff online on my computer.
Okay. Anyway. Liam Neeson.
Yes, that's something I read online and on my computer.
This man. Okay, so he comes out in this interview unprompted. He tells a story about how he's doing press for his new film, which I haven't even looked up. I don't even know the name of it. But I'm pretty sure it's some film where he, you know, goes out and kills and beats up bad guys or whatever. It's all he does anymore. Liam, you're like 67 years old. Come on now. Anyway. So he's given this interview and suddenly tells a story about how he knew a woman, a friend of his, who got raped, and he found out that the guy was black, and he went and roamed the streets with a club looking, and I'm quoting here, to beat up any black bastard that he came across. And then he, oh my God, the self-regard of white men, and I say this as white men, as a white man, but Jesus, he told this story as if he was giving like some teaching some lesson about how he learned the value of how revenge, you know, seeking revenge is empty. And it's like, holy Jesus, Liam, that's not the lesson. The lesson is that you had a racist reaction to a woman's rape and you made it all about yourself. Like, that's the story there. And he seems to have when this first came out, of course, it hit social media first.
And that's always the case.
And
now.
I only had bits and pieces of the interview. And before I had the full interview, I thought, well, oh God, people are going to jump all over him. But all he's doing is trying to admit his own, you know, racist past and that he grew past. And I was like, no, that's not what he's admitting at all. He didn't even seem to understand the racism part of what he was saying. He was making this completely anodyne bullshit point about how revenge and blah, 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 blah. Okay, whatever. That's something you could read in a comic
book. And
then
he went on Good Morning America and make things even worse.
Yeah.
Because
he doesn't understand.
Yeah. Just this whole thing about he went to a priest and then I guess they prayed and then he felt a little better. And then he power walked.
Okay, but where's the part where you were looking for any black man to kill? Where's the part where you examined that?
I know. No, it's all about him, how he healed from that experience.
Right. And this is right on the, we talked about it last week, but this is right a week after Jussie Smollett gets jumped racist and homophobic attack. So I don't know how a fellow actor thought it would be a good idea to be like, you know what? I almost went out and jumped a black guy. Are you thinking?
That's how up in their own asses these people are.
That's what I mean.
That, it's like, that you're giving an interview and that's what you want to say?
That's what I mean about like the just obnoxious self-regard of competent white men who are just like, well, I'm going to teach you a lesson that I learned and completely skip over the parts that are appalling to the rest of society because you're so far in your own head. You think so highly of yourself for not beating up the first black man you saw that you're actually going around telling this story like it's something you should get patted on the back for.
And that's the thing with celebrities. I remember Margot Robbie was interviewed, I forget what magazine, and he said that. She said, you know, it's very dangerous the type of lives we live because we have 10, 15, 20 people around us the whole time, all the time. Always afraid to say we're wrong, that what we're saying is stupid.
Right.
Never, ever criticizing them.
Right.
So they spend their whole lives surrounded by people who
won't tell them that they're assholes.
Surrounded by yes people. And yeah. Then that, I mean, you can't tell me that doesn't affect the way you see the world and how you express yourself. I mean, it really does.
Right. I agree.
And it's a horrible thing because, you know, you're an adult. You should know better. You shouldn't. Even if you think that way, whatever, I can't, you know, I'm not in your head, but when you verbalize it, when you, words come out of your mouth and you say it.
No, I mean, I'm just shocked by it. I didn't think I could be shocked on these matters anymore, but the complete, utter lack of self-awareness in his commentary was just stunning to me.
And I have to bring up something else that happened last night before I went to bed, and I just went to bed angry.
Oh, right.
Michelle Rodriguez. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I actually ended up yelling at her because...
Okay, let me just fill people in. Yes. Michelle Rodriguez, the actress who co-starred with Liam and Viola Davis in Widows this past year.
She's been defending him.
Okay.
And
she said, you know, there's no way Liam Neeson could be a racist. Did you see how he made out with Viola Davis? Are you so freaking stupid that you
think
language
was
racist
a
can't be?
Yeah.
He had his tongue shoved down her throat or something.
Yeah. Do you think a man
dumb that you think racist people don't have sex with? I mean,
right.
Thomas Jefferson raped his slave and had children by her.
Slave owners. I mean, come on. You can't be
That is not the metric
stupid.
Of judging racism. And you as a Latin ex-woman,
right.
Like, how do you...
Oh, my God.
How do you think that way?
I think she was at the MFAR event, and she was interviewed by someone from Vanity Fair.
And people should not give answers like that on red carpets. They should not.
I guess they ask about him, and she goes, because she's been defending him. She said it's bullshit. It's a liar. It's bullshit. That's her language. I'm quoting her. It's bullshit. These are lies and something
lies?
Like that.
He said it.
Right. Right. And then she goes on and on about the Viola Davis. And I actually tweeted to her and I said, you need to apologize to Viola Davis. That is so wrong and offensive.
Yeah. Don't use a black woman to prove that your white man friend is not
racist. A coworker.
Yeah.
You just work with this woman.
I can't imagine Viola was down with that.
No. And especially Viola Davis. She's been so active and so
vocal.
Vocal about racism in this country. And then you use this woman to defend a white asshole?
For wanting to beat up black men?
I was so furious last night, and I actually replied to her on Twitter, and I said, you need to apologize to Viola.
See, I'm of the opinion that in America, and people don't like to hear this, that all white Americans have racist thoughts and racist assumptions all the time. And it is our job as allies, if we care about this sort of thing, to be aware of that, to acknowledge it in our own thoughts and behaviors, and to combat it when it comes up. Living in denial on these matters as white people who, if you do feel that you're an ally, if you do feel that racism is a serious problem in this country, well, it starts with you. It does. I hate to get so damn preachy, but it does. It starts with you. We all need to examine how we're thinking and where those thoughts lead us, because I swear this Liam Neeson thing is a perfect example of just... that cloudy white thinking where you think you're saying something so inspirational or whatever, and you are completely blind to the racism in your commentary, that completely blind to the assumptions that you made and the fact that you didn't linger on them at all. You went out to look for a black guy, any black guy, to
that
kill.
Alone. That,
okay,
that,
and you're not
alone,
the
yes.
fact that you're not examining that is deeply, deeply troubling. And I'm not saying that we all secretly want to go out and kill someone of another race. That's not it. I do think Liam Neeson's is a perfect example of how an inability to see the racism in your own assumptions lead you to making these ridiculous statements. And at one time led him to almost killing someone. Yeah, I mean, what would have happened if he had found the black eye?
Right, right.
Anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, it's been tough. Every time you read the news, I check my phone. It's something else.
It's a rough month for African Americans, and it shouldn't be. But we all need to be having these conversations, my God. And I mean, we all do. Like, I look, Liam Neeson is almost a generation older than me, but he's still an Irish man. I a lot of times in believe it or not, I will sometimes hear someone like Alec Baldwin speak, and he'll say something that the press jumps all over, and he's a real asshole about it, and I'm like, uh-huh. He sounds like a lot of middle-aged Irish guys I know, which is not defending it. It's just, it's a certain mode of identification. And then with Liam Neeson, he's older than me, and he's from Ireland. He's not Irish-American, so I don't claim a lot of kinship with him. But every once in a while over the years, I would hear him say something, because he's one of those really brooding Irish types, of which there are a lot of those men in my family, in the history of my family. So there was that side of him that I was like, yeah, I understand. He's like this brooding Irish. But then he does this, and I'm like, oh, my freaking God, no. That's not something I identify with. That's not something.
Right.
No. And it did. It always, at least at these painful discussions about the history of racism with Irish Americans, and none of it's untrue, but it always, I'm like, oh, that's so painful to hear that my people are, that African Americans think of Irish Americans as racist people. And I'm like, I ain't going to argue with that, but oh, that's painful. Anyway, are you wearing underwear? Mark Skid is curious. What if you could wear the softest, most comfortable underwear you've ever worn thanks to luxurious, earth-friendly, organic Pima cotton? What if you could wear underwear that upcycled a discarded water bottle and turned it into a silky smooth waistband? Silky smooth. I had trouble with that one. What if with every pair, $4 was donated on your behalf to save, feed, and cure the world? Mark Skid is a new underwear company. Yes, the name is deliberate. People keep asking us. Mark Skid is a new underwear company with a mission to make a mark on the world. Mark Skid's belief is simple. Brands should be like the people we love and admire. They should possess a sense of humor, a strong character, and a purpose in living. Let's make a mark together. Use checkout code PODCAST for 15% off and free U.S. shipping. One pair of Mark Skid underwear can plant 4 trees, feed a child for 12 days, or deliver $80 in life-saving medical supplies. And you should go and check out their site, because it is some of the most fun, brightly colored, sexy underwear you've ever
seen. Which is very in right now. I mean, all these bright colors.
Super bright colors. It's very in now. Super soft Pima cotton. Underwear, I mean, it's... Yeah. It's good underwear. It's great underwear, in fact. It's great, stylish, it's fun underwear, sexy underwear, and you're helping to save the world. Mark Skid, comfort for you and the world. So go to markskid.com. That's MarkSkid. MarkSkid.com. Use checkout code PODCAST for 15% off and free U.S. shipping. Thank you, Mark Skid. All right. Have we finished racism hour on this week's podcast? Last week was homophobia hour. This week it's racism hour. Welcome to 2019, everyone.
Yes. Somebody needs to find the keys for that.
Next week it'll be all Islamophobia, and then we're going to tackle misogyny all through the month of March. Misogyny March. No, joking. Let's talk about our book.
Yes.
Ooh, so exciting. Yes, sweetie, we'll go to a break in a little bit. He's doing the hand motions. I personally don't like to go to a break right after a, you know, an advertisement, so I want to keep on talking.
All right, keep talking.
Transparency in podcasting, folks. I feel like it's better that we just talk these things out on the air than make all sorts of hand motions at each other. Like crazy. Awful. I know, I'm terrible.
Anyway.
Okay, so if...
Le book.
If you're someone who listens to this podcast but does not visit our site or check in on our social media, shame.
First of all,
shame on you.
What's wrong with you?
You should be shamed and driven out of town. However, allow us to please announce to you for the first time, because you apparently didn't hear, our second book is coming out in April of 2020. We are extremely excited about this. Like, I've never been so excited about anything professional in my life.
That is very true.
And that includes our first book, which our first book, Everyone Wants to Be Me, Tom and Lorenzo's Fabulous and Opinionated Guide to Celebrity Life and Style. Still can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I love that, like my first baby. I love that book. I always will love that book. And going through that process was incredibly exciting for me at the time, right. You know, as a first-time
author. And it had a lot to do with the site, what we cover, the whole celebrity world that we always talk about.
Right.
So we felt it was a great opportunity to just have a book about it. So people, in a funny way, in a very sarcastic way, explain to people how these people function and how the whole world
It was very much an outgrowth of our thinking and our outgrowth of the philosophy, if you will, of our site. And I love it. I still love it. I'm very, very proud of it. But I think a lot of authors will tell you that a first book is hard. It's just hard. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of second guessing yourself.
An expectation.
And you don't even know what kind of expectations you're supposed to have. Everything is so new. And I'm sure anybody listening to this who wants to become an author someday, who has not had their first book published yet, are sitting here going boo hoo hoo. And believe me, I'm not complaining about the process of having my first book come out. But I will not lie, when we got the offer from Penguin, which was almost 2 months. It was 2 months ago. It was the beginning of December. I was in my office in the back of our place reading the email, and Lorenzo was in the front reading the email, and I came out, and I said, we did it, and I burst into tears. And I don't think I burst into tears the first time I got a book deal. We got a book deal. But we signed for our first book in, I think, 2012. We signed with Perigee. And this was right at the time when all the publishing houses were basically just throwing money at any blogger who had a following in the hopes that they could cash in on that.
It was the time when bloggers were ruling the world. In a way.
We were coming to the tail end of that period.
But my point is that, all eyes were on bloggers.
Right.
And they were offering everything.
And we were happy to ride that wave, believe me. There comes, and this is another thing every writer, practically every writer will tell you, we all suffer from imposter syndrome. None of us believe that we are writers. None of us believe we deserve the attention that we may be lucky enough to secure. And if you read the post on the site, I'm not going to go into it here, but if you read the post introducing this on our site, we detailed that we went through some difficulties post-publication of our first book. That just made it hard to write a second book. It made it impossible. So the years start piling up and you start getting nervous, like, oh my God, are we ever going to get a second book? Because we've kind of let some time go by. And then all this creeping doubt comes in and you think, well, I got that first book because they were throwing money, and anybody would have gotten a book in 2012 with 100,000 Twitter followers. And that's why I burst into tears this time, because we are not riding a huge wave of blogger popularity at this time. I mean, we're fine. Our business is fine, but it's not people. Bloggers, the word blog was on the cover of every magazine eight or nine years ago. It was all anybody in media were talking about. And my point being, there's no sense that we got this offer completely on the skill of our writing and our proposal, not because we were a name or we had a following. That had zero to do with it. And that is so gratifying. Mm-hmm. That 13 years into a blogging career, long after the blogging bubble has popped, you are able to get an editor excited about your work, excited about your proposal.
And yes, we have a book agent, a phenomenal one.
Monica Verma, love
you. Love her. Love her.
She does listen occasionally.
We absolutely love her. I've never dealt professionally with someone so experienced and so down to earth. And she just tell it like it is. Anyway, we love her. My point is that, yes, we do have a book agent. Yes, we had that person to facilitate everything. And we knew how to navigate that world based on our first experience. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, one thing we learned with book publishing is that you might have an incredible idea, and then you go to meetings and you meet all these publishing companies And they just look at it and they say, oh, this is great, but it's not the time, or
right, and
we don't like the tone, or
yeah,
there's not a, there's no, I don't know, there's not a market for this. And I mean, there's always so many things.
Can I?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I just don't want to jump talk over you.
No, that's it.
We just talked about this going into this podcast. Like, when I start going off on this book, I could be here for 2 hours. So I do need Lorenzo to rein me in if I dominate. I do want to outline a little bit of the process of how this finally got sold, this proposal got sold. We talked a bit about this on the introduction post where our agent Monica came to us with the idea. She heard this podcast where we were reminiscing about RuPaul's Drag Race. Oh, have we mentioned? We didn't even mention what the title of the book was. I mean, we just assume that everyone listening knows. Title of the book is Legendary Children, the First Decade of RuPaul's Drag Race and the Last Century of Queer Life. Please go to our site to get a full explanation of what the book is about.
Right.
But it is tying queer history to RuPaul's Drag Race and explaining both at the same time, explaining why RuPaul's Drag Race is structured the way it is, and explaining queer history to perhaps a subset of fandom, because Drag Race has a young,
very young, yeah,
very young fandom who don't know
now,
their queer history.
Especially now, yes.
So that's the basics of the book. Now, Monica heard us talking about how we've been blogging RuPaul's Drag Race for 10 years, and she called us up and said, have you ever thought about doing a book about it? And that just was one of those ideas where you're like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I didn't even think of this because
right.
It's so clearly a good idea. So Lorenzo and I were immediately on board, and Monica was, we were all really excited about the idea, but there were a bunch of factors that made it not a foregone conclusion. No book proposal is a foregone conclusion, but we had factors that we felt were working against us. Number one, this was in July. We knew that the 10-year anniversary was in February, which means all of this had to happen, you know, by then, like by now. There had to be an announcement in place and a book largely ready to go by the time the 10th anniversary rolled around. That was all of our thinking on this process. If the whole pitch was based on the idea of us doing it for 10 years, then the proposal had to be out before the anniversary. So that's a short period of time. Second thing, because of the 10-year anniversary, and just because the show has been popular now for 6 years or so, there are several books out on Drag Race, and there are several books in the publishing pipeline examining drag and that sort of thing. It's a very popular topic right now. That was against us going into it. And we were all, Monica and in all our discussions on this, all three of us were very open about the idea that let's move forward on this with the idea that our careers cannot live or die on it, because the chances of it happening are not great. There's a lot working against it. But we felt it was a good idea and we felt passionate about it. We submitted to Monica a really strong proposal. Stronger than our first book proposal, and I have to admit, I was very energized by that after almost 5 years of fricking around with book proposals that didn't take off or just dropping them completely. It was really nice to get back in the game, to pull something out in the space of a couple of months. That it was like a 30, 40-page book proposal. Maybe it was about a 30-page book proposal. To pull something out and to look at it and go, you know what, that's really professional. That may be some of the best stuff I've done. So that was a very good feeling. And I remember saying to Monica, if everybody turns this down, at least I'm back in the saddle. And she agreed. She was like, this is a good thing. You guys are going to get your names out to a bunch of new editors in New York, blah, blah, blah. So she took that first proposal, shopped it out. Everybody turned it down. I'm just being honest here. Everybody turned it down, but I will say everybody came back and said, we really like their voice. We really like their writing. There's too many Drag Race books right now. We don't really see the need to put another one out in the market. Please, you know, send us something. So we were coming out of this going, all right, it's a net good. It's a net good because there's all these young editors in New York who now have our names and are interested in another proposal. One editor at Penguin Random House said to Monica, I'm not into Drag Race, but there's an editor at Penguin Classics, Elder Roeder, who is a huge fan of the show. I'm just going to pass this. It was like a long shot. Pass this on to her. So it got in the hands of an actual Drag Race fan, and she liked our voice, and she liked aspects of it. I haven't really talked to her about what part she didn't like about the first proposal, and honestly, it doesn't really matter. What she liked was the fact that we kept bringing up queer history in our discussion of Drag Race. At this point, the proposal was basically a fan guide. It was going to be a lot of, you know, top 10 lip syncs and top 10 shady moments, whatever. It was going to be a lot of that kind of thing. You know, a dictionary of drag terms and blah, blah, blah. But we also kept referring to popular figures in drag and queer history and explaining how they relate to the show. Well, Elda loved this idea, and she came back. She sent Monica, our agent, a note, and she said, "This is really interesting. Would they be interested in you know, doing a different sort of book that was more LGBT history focused?" So Monica came back to us with this idea, and we were so excited. I mean, regardless of the fact that this was the only editor who actually was expressing a chance to look at more immediately, she just tapped into something that every once in a while, I mean, we're independent bloggers. We self-publish. We don't have an editor. And I actually miss the days of having an editor, because when you have a good one, they can pull things out of your work that you don't see yourself. And that's it's not that I didn't see it, but I didn't see the possibilities of structuring a whole book proposal around this idea. And Elda did. And it just so happens to be, Lorenzo can attest to this. And if you've ever read the Glee recap when Blaine sang Teenage Dream. That's one of our most famous posts. Or read the Bob Benson post from Mad Style. They're two posts that delve deeply into queer life and queer history. And they are two of the most popular things we've ever written on our site. And they're two of the best things we've ever written on our site. The fact of the matter is, we don't get to write about queer culture as much as we would like to, because that's not the focus of our site. There are a lot of gay blogs out there, gay focused blogs out there, and we don't want to step on the work of other people. But we are passionate about it. We are knowledgeable about it. And when Elda came back with this idea, oh my God, we just lit on fire. Mm-hmm. In fact, I said to Lorenzo, I was like, now we're getting into dangerous territory, because up until now, I've worked on this with the idea that I was, you know, getting back in the saddle, you know, testing my skills again and blah, 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 blah. And now it is turning into something where I will die if it does not get published, where I was so in love with the idea, so in love with the work that and that happened very quickly. It was really funny. Like, it started off as you know what, this is a good idea. Maybe we'll cash in and do a fan guide, to, oh my God, I live and die on this work. It is the best thing we've ever done. So, you know, we did an entirely new proposal. We did not take the existing proposal and just insert things into it. I didn't think that would be a good idea. There's a lot of lessons we learned from our first book. And one of them is, have the DNA of the book just set in your mind from the beginning. Don't try and fit things in upon someone else's suggestion or because you had a later idea. The DNA, the soul of the book, needs to be just in your bones, so you know it well conceptually. So we tore apart the original proposal and rewrote one from the ground up. And TikTok, the clock is ticking at this point. It is October or November at this point. And the 10-year anniversary is in February, and the publishing schedules are long. Like, as you know, we signed in January, and the book is not getting published until the following April. The proposal was submitted in November. So these things take time, and we knew as the clock kept ticking on that if we don't get an answer soon on this, then we're talking about a publication that's happening years after we had hoped. So TikTok, lots of pressure. Oh my God, the research that month that we both did was insane. Because it's not just you have to do research on LGBT history. You have to do research on RuPaul's Drag Race. There's over 100 episodes of that show, plus Untucked, plus All Stars. And it is a book about RuPaul's Drag Race. You have to have the facts and figures. You have to have quotes and stuff. It's a deep dive on 10 years of a reality TV show, while at the same time doing a deep dive on 100 years of gay history. Or LGBTQ history, I should say. long story short, obviously, the it worked. We sent the proposal in mid-November, and at the beginning of December, we got an offer, and then we signed by January. It has been incredibly rewarding to go through this process, not just to go through a process where you're... I mean, book writing is not at all like blog writing, nothing at all like it. Two entirely different skill sets, and it's been 6 years since I did a book, so those skills had atrophied. And I wasn't sure if I could get them back. We were both, you know, it had been some time. It's just really gratifying to have this moment where all of this stuff came together, and a lot of our work is being validated. I mean, anytime a publisher says, yes, your book is interesting, we would like to publish it, that's an enormous validation to any writer. But you just, trust me, you just can't. Mm-hmm. There's nothing beats that feeling, nothing in the world. But it wasn't just that. It was like, wow, we can do long-form writing. It's been a long time, but we can do really long-form writing. And we can do research-based writing, because we hadn't really done research-based writing since Mad Style. And even then, that was only lightly researched. This is some serious deep diving that we're both doing. Just to give you an idea, because it isn't, the book is not a history of drag, because that's far too expansive a topic. Every figure and aspect of queer culture that is outlined in the book is something that ties to Drag Race specifically. The thing is, a lot of people don't realize how much queer culture actually does funnel its way into Drag Race. So it is a broader look at queer culture, but it's still structured around the idea of RuPaul's Drag Race specifically. So we've already had some questions. Are you going to include this person? Are you going to include that person? And look, when you get into the history of queer art, queer performance, queer music, queer theater, all of that stuff, you were talking about some like major, major figures. There's a chapter on the sketch comedy challenges on RuPaul's Drag Race and how they tie to theatrical traditions in drag and that sort of thing. I am not going into the whole thesis because, of course, I want you to buy the book. But we had literally dozens of figures in theater and cinema history who advanced their career through drag. One name that came up, Harvey Fierstein. This titanic figure in queer theater, and who crosses over with drag history tremendously because he wrote the book for La Cage aux Folles, he wrote the book for Kinky Boots. You know, he wrote Torch Song Trilogy, which was about a drag queen looking for love. So there's an example of someone who looms really large. And in our version of the chapter, we had paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs about his work, and then it all got cut. Because it has nothing to do with RuPaul's Drag Race, not in a direct sense. And when you read the book, you'll understand why. Because it's not just here's people that worked in theater who were also drag queens. It's here's people that worked in theater and cinema who created the kind of acting that you see on Drag Race. That's what we're talking about. Here's, you know, people who worked in fashion that created the kind of looks that you see walk that runway every week. So it's been very exciting, but it's also very sobering, because how do you look at, you know, two or three pages of Harvey Fierstein work and be like, it's not going to make it, snip, and you cut it out? That's a hard thing to do when you're writing what you call a queer cultural history. But trust me when I say it all ties together in a very exciting way. Lorenzo, why don't you talk about the naked guy part of the book?
No, as Tom said, if you watch the show, you kind of understand what we're talking about here, because what we're trying to do is to sort of illustrate everything that you see on the show using history, using representation, and everything that the LGBT community did throughout history.
Yeah.
And you see that on the show because RuPaul is very clever about that. She created all these categories. She created the sketch segment.
Right.
Or the
library.
The library, the interviews and all that. The interviews, the pit crew, you know, that's why you
Snatch
see.
Snatch game, right.
That's why you see everybody there. You see the guys there. That's why you see them singing and acting. You see the drag queens doing all that stuff. And it's cleverly tied up to the LGBT community and,
right.
and how it was expressed throughout history. And that's what we're doing. We're getting these elements and putting them together with something that the show does.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it, because then you really understand. And the great thing about that is that if you know the LGBT community history well enough, you're going to love that it's tied up. You're going to see all these connections
right.
to elements of the show. And if you don't know anything about the LGBT community history, but you know a lot about the show, you're also going to be
right.
amazed by the fact that you're learning all that history.
Right.
So that's what we wanted to do. It's not just have another book out there about the LGBTQ history.
There's plenty of historians
right, right.
who wrote wonderful books,
right.
that some of which we're using as resources.
In a way, and we've mentioned that in the post, if you want to read the post, it's sort of like the approach we had with Mad Men.
Very much so.
That we're analyzing, we picked something that nobody was talking about, and decided to run with it.
Making cultural connections
right,
and references
right, right.
along
and
the way.
And just to address a question that we get a ton, many, many times, is that the reason why we don't have a book about Mad Style, that came up. But
5 years ago, yeah.
But the reason why we don't have a book about Mad Men Style is, A, it was kind of a little late for that when we actually thought about it, and B, it would be a nightmare in terms of copyright.
Right.
For all the pictures, for everything.
It just couldn't happen.
To have a book with that many pictures. It just wouldn't happen. So we, unfortunately, we had to drop that. And our style book, because we get questions about that too, we will eventually do a style book. But we felt, as we mentioned in the post, I don't want to repeat what we said in the post too much, but it was just not the right time for that.
No.
So yes, put a pin in it. We're still doing it. We're just not doing it right now. But that's it. We're very excited about the book, Legendary Children. It's a book that we feel, that we believe, that it will be entertaining, but also
educational
and
illuminating
in many, many ways. So we're very,
just to
very
get back to, because I really wanted you to talk about the naked guys, because you're doing the research on this part of it. As an example of what we're trying to do, the pit crew has its own chapter. And the point of the pit crew chapter, again, without giving it any, let's do it this way. The book is broken down by chapters, and each chapter is an examination of an aspect of the show. The second chapter is on the workroom. The third chapter is on the library. The fourth chapter is on the Snatch Game. The fifth chapter is on the sketch comedy challenges, and the sixth chapter is on the pit crew. There's also chapters on the runway, chapters on Untucked, chapters on the music challenges, among others. All these are tied to historical figures and cultural moments, but they also, each chapter deals with a specific aspect or concept of LGBTQ life and history. So there are chapters where the core concept deals with respect, or oppression, dealing with violence, or mainstream respectability, or family life, sex. All of these things are, because it's all about queer life, it's all about the many aspects of queer life. There's even a bit that deals with spirituality and the forward-thinking aspect of drag and how it literally attempts to change the world. So all of this, there's some heady stuff in here. But I love the pit crew chapter the most, because it's not heady at all. It's just about bulges and asses. But it does actually tie that in. There is, I should also make clear that this isn't a book about, we keep saying queer and LGBTQ for a reason. This isn't a book about gay men. One of the things we wanted that came up in our research that made us really excited about the concept for the book is, when you go into the history of drag, it's not a history of solely gay men. It's a history of transgender women. It's a history of transgender men. It's a history of lesbians. There are all the colors of the rainbow are in that world, are in the history of that world. So we are not just doing, you know, outlines of gay men. There are plenty of transgender women featured in this book. And part of the reason that excites us is because RuPaul's Drag Race has always had a sort of problematic relationship with its transgender contestants and its transgender fans. And Ru has actually said a few things that got him in trouble. And what came out in our research is like, holy cow, like, there were always transgender women in drag. Like, it has never even, I don't even know where Ru's coming from on this, because some of them are his friends, like Candace Kane. And some of them are very important figures. Some of them lived really fascinating lives. And they're the ones that we're really excited to put into the book to make people understand that we're, you know, we're going to do a profile of Stormy DeLarvarie, who is this sort of iconic lesbian drag king figure who legend tells the tale that she punched a cop at Stonewall, although that's probably just legend. But she was a drag king for many, many, many years, and she traveled with one of the biggest drag reviews in the country for many, many years. Seminal figure in drag history, seminal figure in LGBTQ history, and it all gets filtered through the lens of RuPaul's Drag Race. When we talk about the pit crew, we're going to talk about things like the long history of go-go boys in gay nightlife. The fact that for the last 30 years, every pride parade in every city in America has a float with drag queens and porn stars on it. The idea of semi-naked men and drag queens is an idea that goes all the way back to the earliest days of drag. They've always been hand in hand. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at. And then we get to look at things like erotic artwork of the 1950s that, you know, sort of defined the image of the man in the Speedo and that sort of thing. So we hope we're giving you the impression. It's a fun book. It draws a lot of connections from a lot of different areas. We are super excited about it. It's intersectional as hell. We are doing everything we can to make sure the rainbow is represented as well as possible.
Right.
The experiences of people of color and the experiences of transgender people and non-binary people and bisexual people in the drag and performing communities are all represented in this book, because that's very important to us. Part of our journey to writing this book, and you have heard us talk about this, we did an entire podcast about this about a year and a half ago, was our struggle as gay men to watch a show that used to be about gay male culture. And it did. The first 3 or 4 years on Logo, it was strictly about gay men. It took on a new audience, a broader audience, and it became less about gay male culture and more about LGBTQ culture at large, or, you know, in general. So that was our journey as viewers, and it became our journey towards writing this book. Anyway, we hope you get some idea of what we're talking about. Do you want to add anything?
No, I guess we're very excited about it.
We are.
We're in the process of you know, working very hard on it. But that's pretty much it. We just wanted to give you guys an idea.
Yeah, we're so excited.
Of what the book is about.
Yeah.
And, we're very, very excited about it, especially being part of the community. It means a lot to us.
After all these years, as writers and as bloggers, it's really, truly exciting to take a turn into LGBTQ writing and being, you know, I mean, it's funny. We've always been, how could you not see us as gay bloggers? It was part of our brand. Our first blog was called Project Run Gay. But I think we're not always placed in that segment of LGBTQ media people,
right,
or critics. And I'm really excited about this, because I feel like this book is positioning us there rather well.
Right, right, right.
And it's sort of a new page, a new chapter in our... It's nice. It's nice after 13 years that you're writing a new chapter.
Right.
And it's an exciting one. So good things are coming. We're very, very excited about this. We will be promoting the book by writing little bios and stuff like that, doing a little bit of queer history stuff on the site, which I'm really excited about doing, just little posts explaining figures were. And we're working very hard to get some drag queens on this podcast. We have a yes, so I'm not going to say from who, But this bitch better get back to us soon because we've been going back and forth with her and she's supposed to be stopping by. And we're not doing this to promote the book. Like, we're not bringing them on to talk about our book. We're just doing this to dive fully into drag world and to make sure it's part of, you know, it's more part of our brand than it's been in the past, I guess.
I agree.
Anyway.
Yes.
Lorenzo thinks I've talked too much.
No, I'm just listening now.
I know. Mm. Lorenzo thinks I've talked too much. All right. I think we're done, sweetie. I think we've talked everyone to death. I hope you're as... If you are half as excited about this book as I am, then I've done my job. Yes. So thank you for all your support, kittens. Thank you for all the well wishes this week over our announcement.
Yes, it was very, very, very,
very touching. Yeah, we love you all.
Emails and everything we got. Thank you.
And my editor, and our editor and agent, we're very happy.
So thank you.
Yeah, so keep on like
keep
having
them coming.
Enthusiastic responses like that that we can measure and point to. And we will, of course, have pre-order information for you as soon as it is available.
And book tour.
And book tours and all sorts of fun things down the line. So keep tuning in and keep stopping by. And we thank you for all your support once again. And we love you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.